Hey guys, welcome to Hope It Helps. Today's guest is Leendert van Treat. Leendert is a Dutch-American composer for visual media, currently completing his master's degree in musical composition and score writing in Sofia, Bulgaria. His passion and dedication for the field is truly inspirational, and he is on the fast track to becoming a key figure in the industry. During this episode, we discuss the fundamentals of score writing for both movies and video games. He shares with us the immense complexities and challenges of the field, what the score writing process looks like, and his dream projects for the future. And the last message he wanted to share is to ignore your calling is the biggest disservice you can do to yourself. Please join me in welcoming to the show, Mr. Leendert van Treat.
Yeah, thanks, man. Thanks.
How you doing?
I'm doing well.
Thanks so much for your time, man, and for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. So, Leendert, you do something, you're studying something quite niche and unique, which is writing scores for films and for movies. And we had a brief discussion the other day, and you were telling me about what is it that drew you to that field? What are the opportunities that are there? So I kind of wanted to dive in today with you about what is this field? Because I think a lot of us don't really know, unless you're in it, like what it takes, what's the process, what's the good, what's the bad. So would love to hear from you, you know, your perspective on all those things. But before we get into everything, Leendert, why don't you give all of us a little bit of background about yourself, and we'll take it from there.
All right. Yeah, my name is Leendert van Treat. I am a Dutch and American composer for visual media.
Yeah.
Currently studying in Sofia, Bulgaria. And gonna see where exactly that takes me.
Yeah, man. So could you tell us, like, what drew you initially to the field? Because we were talking yesterday, I was under the impression previously that you'd need to have some type of musical background to enter that. But after my discussion with you, it sounds like it's more, I'm sure musical background is very helpful in the work that you do, but it's not a necessity. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's definitely, like, you've got an array of skills that you sort of need, but you don't need all of them to be able to succeed. I mean, famously, Hans Zimmer doesn't know how to read sheet music, but is...
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, what?
Yeah, yeah, no, it's really cool. But the man is very, very good with technology and can create the sounds. He doesn't need, at the end of the day, you don't need to know how to write sheet music or how to read sheet music if you can create cool sounds. Really, that's what it boils down to. You need to be able to create cool sounds, and you need to figure out how to use those cool sounds.
That's very interesting. So what is it about him, I guess, because he's widely recognized as one of the, if not the best score writer for films, like, ever. You know, like the Interstellar soundtrack, like Interstellar score is legendary.
Yeah, you know, yeah, no, absolutely.
So what is it about him? I guess the question I'm trying to ask is, what are the characteristics of a great, let's say, film score writer? Let's start there.
Fair. There's a lot of different styles of film scoring. Even at that, like, it's hard to compare a Hans Zimmer to the likes of, for example, John Williams. You know.
It's an unfair comparison?
It's not that it's an unfair comparison. It's that you're comparing apples to a building. They really do come from completely different disciplines. And you see that with a lot of the guys at the top level, like the likes of Danny Elfman and Chris Young, for example, who both are very, very serious names in the industry. Also didn't come from a classical background like John Williams did. They did have a musical background, but they had a musical background in playing in a band.
Okay.
In more of a, like, pop context.
Gotcha.
And so really the only thing that's particularly important about it really is that you need to be able to create cool sounds. However you do that doesn't really matter. Hans Zimmer, he is very good at distilling music to its most simple, most important elements. That's the thing that he does very well, and then he can produce that incredibly well. Really, it's the production that sets him apart from everyone else. It's how he's able to blend very simple materials and create something that feels very, very grand.
Yeah, that's such a great way to put it, because from my, from an outsider's perspective that doesn't know the field, doesn't understand what he's doing, it sounds very, what's the word? Like his music has always sounded, I just keep thinking of Interstellar. It's very like, is the word full? Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I wasn't sure if that was the right word. Full, like heavy, like
yeah, heavy, there's a body majestic, to it.
Yeah,
very rich.
So how does, so that, and he's just, and that's just him creating, as you say, the cool sounds and layering them together to create one unified piece of music in a way?
Yes,
or is that kind of how it works?
I mean, then you sort of get into the question of, you know, what even is music? You've got so many different definitions that have popped up over the years, but really music is just a collection of sounds that are intentionally put together that sound, that's not actually entirely true.
Yeah.
You don't want it to sound good if you're writing for horror.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's just a collection of sounds that are put together with intentionality.
That's
what music is. And if that collection of sounds put together in that particular way can evoke some sort of emotion, it's doing something right.
Okay. So, okay. You said a very key point there. So is the metric to determine the success of like this musical sound or this musical piece, whether it made me feel the way you intended it to make me feel, or the way I just, or it didn't make me, or any emotional like influence?
Depends on the scenario.
Okay.
I feel like for music independently from the screen, very often it is just trying to get you to feel something.
Okay.
Whether or not you feel exactly what the composer intended or not is not the most critical element, as long as it makes you feel something. I can't remember who said, but essentially, when they write music, the idea was that it was better for the audience to have a negative reception than no reception to it at all.
Really?
Writing something that felt gross was better than something that would sound boring.
Gotcha. Okay.
Because you, at the end of the day, it is about creating something that makes you feel something.
Yeah. And
especially so with film. Now, at that point, you do sort of have to create something that is a little bit more universal, because you're working with filmmakers, film directors, to give them something that realizes their vision.
Yeah.
They want the audience to feel a specific thing, because they're telling a very specific story. Something that music, unless it literally is telling a story like in some sort of opera, or like if it's just an independent piece, you don't have that.
Okay.
But so in film, you do have it that generally you want your piece to convey a specific emotion, but even then it doesn't necessarily need to do that. Sometimes it just needs to propel energy. That's the only thing it needs to do. It can let the scene speak for itself, but just needs to keep the film feeling like it's moving.
Yeah. I get what you're saying. I get what you're talking about. That like it's the grease that keeps the wheels moving in a sense.
Yeah, exactly. Because there's sometimes there are pieces of music that aren't. They're not built to say anything. They're just built as like sort of as a canvas. And the music, it really is just a canvas that allows for the film to speak. That's especially more modern scores that lie more in the minimalistic sort of tradition.
Yeah,
are able to do that quite well.
Okay,
because by its nature, minimalistic music tends to sit in one space and let something else do the talking.
Gotcha. Yeah. So it sounds like there's so many things you just mentioned that we're going to dive into, because there's like each one's like a point.
Yes, sorry about
that. No. This is great. I love this, because I'm like, all right, we're thinking along the same lines. All right. So let's take a step back. So what I've taken so far from our conversation is clearly score writing, if that's what it's called, is very project or situation dependent, in the sense that the way I would score a film is not the way I'm going to score a video game, for example, or to score a different type of project. Now, my question then, because the question I then start thinking about is score writing a very structured 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 process? And does that, first of all, what does that process look like? And does it change depending on what the type of project you're working on?
It definitely changes depending on the type of project you're working on.
Your actual process of how you would do it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, are you talking about the process as like from the moment you're brought onto a project? Okay. Because in that case, there's a little bit more structure to it. As more overarching structure. It's once you get to the composing itself that everything sort of hits the fan.
Okay.
But in the projects themselves, generally the idea is you get brought into the project, you get informed about generally what the intentions of the project are. If they're far long enough in the process, you do what's called a spotting session. Essentially, you watch through the materials with the filmmaker, discuss where music is wanted, where music's not wanted, what sort of music is wanted. And after that, you sort of just get to the writing part.
Okay. So it's the, is it out of that process that you just described for you as on a personal level, is it the composition that's the most challenging, or is it the link to fit into that relevant part of the project?
Of the things described, definitely the, it's more so the trying to completely understand what the vision for the film is. That's the harder part for me.
Yeah.
That being said, really the hardest part is trying to find a project in the first place. But it really is, because writing is something that comes relatively, not easily, but comes relatively naturally. Like if with practice, you sort of are able to just create if you need to create.
Sure.
But it's creating with guidance of somebody else's vision who might not have the words to describe it in the way that you would describe it.
Okay.
It's, you sort of have to act as like a translator as well as
so
a composer.
That's so interesting. Yeah. So because I was thinking, like, if you brought me on to a project and I'm like, Linda, this is what you, I want this scene to feel sad, for example.
Yeah.
You write the score and whatever. Now, because there's the challenge becomes, I think, in any type of collaborative creative project is, you know what you want. I'm here to bring that vision to life. However, I have in my opinion, it should sound like this.
Yeah.
But you're saying no, it should sound more like that. And I think that from as the score writer, that's where I think it's. It would be the most challenging. Would that be fair to say, or is it wrong?
Yeah,
or?
No, for sure. Because if we use the example you used of you want it to be sad, what is sad? You know, there's a lot of different approaches you can take to creating something sad. You've got your classic, you know, I miss you song, or you know, a things aren't working out sort of song, but one of the most devastating pieces, in my opinion, to have been written for film is the music in the opening montage for Up.
Okay.
Which is, if you would have listened to it independently of the film first, it's a very, very cheerful melody. It's a very cheerful melody. It's happy harmony. Everything is so good about it, but you put it to the screen and suddenly you need to cry.
Yeah. Yeah. That's...
So a lot of it is about, you know, trying to figure out what is even meant by sad, you know? And sometimes you don't even get such global descriptors. Sometimes, especially with very artistic filmmakers, you get descriptors that are completely visual and you have to try and interpret what exactly that means.
Yeah. And I feel that would be challenging because he's trying to get you to think in pictures and you're working in sound.
Exactly.
You know what
exactly.
I mean? Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, and I love that you brought up the up example, because that's a great example of a juxtaposition between a happy song put to a certain type of, you know, scene gives it a completely different, you know, meaning, both positive to negative, negative to positive.
Yeah.
When you're, because this is something I didn't really, when I was doing my research, this is an area I didn't really understand. So I'm curious to get your insight on this. They said when it comes to film writing, your job is to create a linear narrative through your sound. But when it comes to video games, for example, video games are a lot more reactionary and situational and occupational, and it's a lot changing at the time. So first of all, I want you to explain when they're talking about a linear narrative, because that is something I struggle to see, because each scene in a movie is going to have different type of music that's going to go with it. So to see a cohesive linear narrative, as they were describing it, I struggle to see that, but would love to hear your perspective.
Yeah, no. So the big thing with that one is that because the entire structure is already set, what you can do with the music, the same way that you might with visuals, you can foreshadow important moments.
Okay.
In the music, you can use the music to highlight important moments that will come back later. There's a great score for What Lies Beneath,
okay,
I believe it is, where what the composer did was they created the climax of the whole film. That was the first piece they wrote, and just really, really massive, massive piece. And what they did is they broke it down into little sections, like every single melodic part in that entire piece. They then threw all over the score in the rest of the movie, so it felt like all of these little moments suddenly built up into this culmination, this piece that, like, wow, everything was foreshadowed to become this.
That's
this
awesome.
Was inevitable. You know, you have that ability when you've got something that's already set in stone, so it can build along with the film.
Yeah, I guess I'm sure with score writing, typically, sorry to interrupt you, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'm guessing it has to be, they have to shoot the movie first and then you write the score. Can you do it? Yeah. But I feel like you could also, now that I'm thinking about it, it would be a lot harder, but you could probably do it the other way around. I could write a sad piece and then film a scene to fit that emotion or that music.
Yeah, correct. And that is possible, especially when you start getting into like art film. I have a friend of mine who did exactly that, essentially wrote a piece and then started filming and doing a lot of choreography with some people at home, and created this relatively compelling, really, it is on the art film side,
yeah.
But that really does tend to be more on the art film side, because generally you want to start with the story you're trying to tell, right?
Absolutely.
Now, nowadays, it's not super uncommon at the higher level that the composer does get brought in a little bit earlier on before they've shot everything, so that they can start interacting with the director, filmmaker earlier on, so that they can explore what sonic palette they want to use, essentially.
Yeah.
Which is very helpful. It obviously costs more time, but
sure,
what it allows is for one of the bigger problems that we end up facing is the temp score.
The temp score.
So essentially, the temp score is just with the film, when we receive it, they've put in temporary music, and there's some great things about temp scores. It helps guide us in the direction that the filmmaker wants if we aren't completely certain, and we can use it as like a, hey, what do you like about it? What would you change about it?
Gotcha.
Which is really, really helpful. However, you also have the situation where you can get locked into that sort of color palette, especially because of sometimes the filmmakers just fall in love with the temp score, and no matter what you will end up writing, it won't be the temp score that they got used to.
I see. So it's like okay, it's a decision. Do I want to do it on the, like, do I bring it, like, do I change it then, or do I do it before, and what's the
bring the composer on earlier is helpful, because you can sort of avoid that. You can if the composer is already very involved in that and you can trust them, it is really based on trust if you're going to do that.
Okay. Yeah.
The composer can be brought in earlier, and then the need for a temp score is much, much lesser, because you've already discussed exactly what you want to do. You've already sort of played around with the colors of the music.
Yeah. So, in your, like, in the, what is a, let's say I want to create a scenario where we can kind of go through step by step how me and you working together, what would that look like? So I'm like, hey, Linda, I have a movie. I want to write a score for it. What is that initial process that I just described, what does that look like? What are the steps that we need to take? And because I can imagine with anything artistic or creative, there could be 1,000 revisions and, you know, tweak this and do that and so on. So I'd love to hear what the next steps would be.
So you're coming to me with a film.
A film ready. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So the first step really would probably be, well, for one, I would want to discuss generally what are you trying to do with this film. Then I would want to sit down with you and slowly go through the film, and wherever you feel like music is needed, you let me know, hey, I think that this is where we'd want music. Keep note of all of this. I'll comment on where I feel like music might be needed, or if you say, hey, I think music's needed here and I disagree, we can discuss that. That's actually one of the more important parts of the process, is that sitting there with the filmmaker and going through all of it and discussing, hey, these are the parts that are important to us to have music in, and what should the music be doing?
Yeah.
And what colors do we want for the music? What do you want the score to look like?
You touched on it a moment ago as well. You said the colors of the music. Could you tell me what you, because that's new to me. So that, very, very interesting though.
Yeah. I suppose that's, it's a little bit hard to describe, but it's no different than colors for a painting. You know, you've got a bunch of different colors and you can use them to create a painting. And paintings that feel more cohesive sometimes have a limited amount of colors. It just helps blend everything together better, right?
Okay,
it feels like the whole piece is more cohesive if the same colors are used throughout, instead of just mostly that, but then for some reason some other colors are being used in this section.
Okay.
It can be intentional to do that, and you can do the same thing in film scoring, but it's similar in film scoring. But I would be talking about more so instruments that you might be using.
Gotcha.
How aggressive you'd be going with the music, just generally the intensity. You know, what type of sound design would they need? Do you want something that's more flowing, majestic, or do you want something you could do on strings, for example? Or is it a film that would benefit more from a more minimalist approach with more percussive instruments?
Gotcha.
There's a lot of different avenues.
I feel it's the possibilities are of what you could do are endless.
Absolutely.
And there's not really a, in quotations, a ruled book on you can't do this, but you can do that.
Yeah, right? I feel like it really is the same as painting in that way. You've got an infinite amount of colors, and you can use them in an infinite amount of ways, and some will work better than others, And as long as by the end you've got something that looks like what you want it to look like, if it evokes what you want it to evoke, then that's a success.
So I'm curious, through like now you, through your program, because before you had this understanding of like the colors of, you know, what the sound, the colors of the sounds and so on, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. You probably, I feel like going through this program has not only from a creative perspective opened up a world of possibilities, but I think you get a different now lens of how you see like video and audio and games. Like I could watch a movie and I'm not paying attention to the sound unless it's a song I might know. I'll be like, oh sick, they put that, but that's it. You would look at it kind of like when I first learned, for example, how to DJ years ago. What happened was when I started going to clubs, now I know what a DJ is supposed to like sound like. I know what's a good transition, what's a bad transition. So like I'd be in the club and people might be having a good time, but in my head I'm like, man, this guy fucking sucks, bro. Like, he's shit. What is this? Do you have has this process of going through this given you that same kind of like lens to look through?
A little bit. Okay. Not too much. I'm very good at just sitting there and enjoying things for the most part. But it definitely has now gotten to the point that at the very least, when it's bad, I notice it.
Okay.
When it's really bad, I notice it.
Yeah.
But the thing is that when it's good, it doesn't draw attention to itself. Unlike music as a standalone, that's good. It is trying to draw attention to itself because it is a standalone. You know, it is trying to draw attention to itself.
Yeah.
When a film score is done effectively, ideally you barely notice it's there and you're still left humming it.
That's a great example of it. Okay.
It's a very, very interesting balance to try and strike as a composer.
Yeah, do you judge the because I was gonna ask you what determines a good film score and what doesn't. Because I can look at it, I can analyze it in two ways. I can analyze it solely as how good was the actual score, the music itself, like the production of it, all that. I can analyze it like that. Another way to look at it is how well, not necessarily about the quality of production, whatever, but how well did it bring out what this scene or this was trying to do?
Yeah.
So which, does it fall on, is it both or is it?
It is, in my eyes, is entirely more important for it to bring out the emotions it needs.
Gotcha. Okay.
If it works as a standalone, that's great. If you write music like John Williams or like Hans Zimmer, often you'll end up getting something that it serves the picture incredibly well, and it happens to also be great as a standalone.
Gotcha.
But there are some really, really great scores out there that you would not want to listen to.
Like as just like like music alone, like standalone music.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Like specifically once you start getting into the more like horror direction, a lot of that is entirely built to be unpleasant.
Yeah.
But it is purposefully unpleasant in a way that serves the scene very well, that keeps you on edge.
Oh yeah, you know that, like that, you know, when something's about to happen in like a horror film, you know, that dun-dun, like that,
exactly,
that silence or that little like sound.
Yeah, I would shit my pants. I'm awful with horror.
Oh fuck horror movies. I don't understand. I have friends that like they love it and whatever. I'm like, I don't understand how you enjoy being scared. But you know,
me too.
That's you.
Yeah, I'm such a jumpy person. But I can definitely appreciate
sure.
the scores because some of them are really really good.
Yeah. I can. You talking about how, particularly in this example for horror, and I can't imagine horror music ever sounding like a piece of music, a standalone piece of music.
Yeah.
But something more maybe positive or happy, there might be some chance because they might hit, you know, some different notes.
Yeah.
So we've kind of talked about like the music, the film side of scores.
Yeah.
Let's dive into video games.
All right.
An area that I think... probably both of us are familiar with, you know, growing up playing games. Like when I think about like, I don't know if you'd call this the score, but so you could tell me otherwise. I think of scores like Mario, like Zelda, like Pokemon, like
yeah.
The ones that, like, if you play that, I don't need to see anything. I know what, I know what that is.
Yeah.
So, and because now that we've kind of discussed that with video games, it's much more situational than, like, there's an overarching story and, like, piece. So I feel, from my perspective, video game scoring is 20 million times harder if that's the case.
Yes and no.
Okay.
It's got its own challenges.
Okay.
It's got its own challenges.
Okay.
Some parts are easier, some parts are harder.
Okay.
The easier part is that you don't have to worry nearly as much about the linearity of it.
Okay.
Sort of like what we were talking about before. And you don't have any specific moments that you need to be like, oh, right here, I need to have some sort of shift. I need to line things up for everything to change here, but also I can't really change exactly there, or it's the audience is going to think it's too cheesy.
Sure.
So you don't have to worry about any of that. You sort of have to just write a piece, and the way that it's often done is you write a piece in layers.
Okay.
This is a much more modern version of it. This was not the case for the original Pokemon
Zelda
scores, just because of the hardware. But nowadays, with the hardware that we have available, what you do is you've got multiple different layers, and you've got the base layer, which is relatively chill, and which is what you've got as sort of your baseline.
Okay.
But as the intensity builds up, you can fade in the second layer, which works with the first layer, but has a little bit more energy.
Okay.
And say you end up in a like high intensity combat scenario, you might then bring in the third layer, or if there could even be more layers. It's not necessarily three. Three is relatively standard.
Okay.
But you might bring in the last one, which is just absolutely massive compared to the other ones, and is just really, really building intensity. But they're all essentially the same piece, but just stretched apart.
Okay.
Into three different pieces, but they're built to play together.
Okay, interesting. And in that example, is the found that, like, let's say layer one, is that the most important layer because everything else I'm gonna build on top of that?
It depends.
Okay.
Yeah. Honestly, all of the layers are quite important, because the truth is, if any of them are done poorly, it's going to be unfortunate. Because if you've got a bad layer one, then your, like, base, like, if you're not fighting enemies, if you're just exploring, then the exploration becomes lame.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, true.
But if your layer three is bad, then the boss fight's bad.
Yeah, I get you.
Like, everything that's been built up to is just disappointing. All of the work you put into final confrontation is just, it feels like it's been, it was all for nothing, you know?
Yeah.
You want to reward all that's happened before it. So each of the layers really are quite critical for the experience.
Yeah. Based on that, I was thinking, I'm like, where is it easier? Where would it be easier to hide? Like, to hide, you know, in terms of like a bad layer, would it be in like a video game, or would it be in a movie? Like, where am I going to notice it more? Just off the bat, I think because video games have so many more sounds going on anyway, besides whatever I'm doing, like you correctly said, there's that baseline that carries through, I feel it's easier to hide there because there's not really an emotion. Like, I am trying to convey an emotion, but it's different to when it's in the context of a story.
Yes. So in games, indeed, you're more so trying to convey the general energy.
Gotcha. Yeah.
But that being said, as far as like where to hide something that's worse, I could make the argument that in film, because it's linear, you only pass the bad moment once.
Okay.
Because gaming is built on loops, the bad thing's going to show up again and again and again. And at some point, you're going to notice that it's bad. And every time it passes, you're like, ah, that stupid thing again.
Okay, I see what you mean. That's a different way of looking at it. Yeah, but I get where you're coming from.
Yeah, but pros and cons to everything. Pros and cons to everything.
Absolutely, man, for sure. And we talked the other day about one of the things that drew you to the field was the tech aspect and how you could use code to bring this bring all of these different things and musical pieces to life. So obviously that naturally then means I'm like, okay, tech. Where's tech? Tech. Where are we now? Where are AI now? With the work that you do, it's very interesting, AI, because obviously I've heard now, the world has heard like those full music, like full songs that sound exactly like, that sound like Drake, that were done by AI, and you can create you can use people's voices with AI now. There's so much you can do. Now,
yeah,
I can see that as a good thing for the field, but I feel like in your world, I could see it being a big problem, because then people are just going to be like, I'll get this AI to analyze this film for me and write the perfect calculated structured AI score. So then it loses that, like, how, I guess the question then becomes, how important is the human creativity touch in the work that you do?
Yeah, I mean, I'd argue that that human touch is very important.
Okay.
And is noticeable, especially as it relates to even starting in the correct direction. It's cool if an AI can write Drake or some imitation of Drake.
Sure.
I personally don't think it's quite there, but it's an impressive imitation of it.
Yes, yes.
But being able to do that versus be able to judge exactly how to create an emotion,
mm-hmm.
B, how to create an emotion originally, then you have to figure out what colors does the director want.
Mm.
Because Drake's great, but I'm not going to put Drake in the score for Up, right?
Yeah, sure.
And every score really does have its own character. And even in scores that are entirely entirely orchestral, if you even completely limit the instrumentation for it, the voice of the composer can still very much be heard through that.
Okay.
Frankly, I would be shocked if at some point an AI is able to like really, really accurately imitate the style of, for example, a John Williams. Now, I'm taking the most extreme example of classically trained with so much detail in his music that you could spend years and years and years just analyzing his scores. But I think that when you have that and every other possible genre of music, it's going to take a powerful AI to be able to for one, imitate all of those, and then on top of that, decide when it's supposed to use those, and then create a cohesive score.
Okay, so there's a lot. So from your, it sounds like, wow, the way you described it just now in that like process was like, each one of those is like a world of its own in that process.
Yeah.
In that overall process, each one of those steps is like a world of its own. And yeah, because I've been having these debates, people about AI, like a guest asked me recently, he's like, do you think an AI could take like, do what I do, which is like the podcasting and stuff. And I thought about it. I'm like, you might be able to have a good conversation. You might be able to have good questions and good answers. That I think it could do that very well. But this, what we're doing right now, this, the human element, the chemistry, the smiles, all these little things, from my perspective, make it. It will never be able to one kind of like what you're saying, 100% replicate that, because the human element is almost it's the main piece. It seems small, but it's the main piece underlying all of this.
Yeah, exactly. For a lot of those, I do think that it is sort of a, you can maybe get to 95%, but even then, on top of that, you sort of have that. I think an AI could do any of those individually.
Yeah.
But I do not think an AI would be able to do all three of those at the same time.
Interesting.
I think that would take too much of a deep understanding of how the human mind itself works.
Okay. Now,
potentially very, very down the line, once AIs have mapped out the human brain and figured out how it works exactly. I mean, at that point, we're doomed.
It's over. Yeah, by then.
Yeah, so I don't have to worry about that. Either I can keep doing my job, or it's too late anyway. It's all hopeless.
That's I love that example. So with the course that you do, like with scoring, what, because we touched on this a little bit the other day about the about like sonic branding and all that kind of stuff and the importance of it and stuff. And I can see scoring fitting right. Essentially, is that on like a massive scale, basically?
Yeah, essentially.
So do you think that when it comes to like actually composing the score, will we ever get to a point that it will be, how do I phrase this question? I'm struggling a little bit. Let me come back to it. Let it percolate in the brain a little bit. But I wanted to actually touch on some of the misconceptions. I'm back. Okay. What I wanted to ask is, what other opportunities does studying like or going through this program or studying score open up? Because maybe some people listening to this might be like, interested in music or so on, but like I don't want to write film scores, but I don't want to but I also don't want to write like video game scores. Sonic branding might seem cool. So like, what other avenues does someone with your background be able to like enter or venture into? I'm just curious if there's ones that I'm not even aware of.
Fair. I mean, obviously people who have exactly my background are probably pretty damn interested in film scoring. I mean, I spent the last 5 years of my life very much only studying, very deliberately studying media scoring. So
really,
my entire undergrad and now my master's has been with a focus in film scoring.
Okay.
So, but even then, sort of parallels to it in even in film, you've got jobs like music editors, who get paid more than the composers do.
Really?
Yeah. Music editors is a lot of film composers actually try and go get into film composition through the music editor job, just because it's something that is not as it's not quite as glamorous, but is potentially equally as important.
So the music editor is the guy who comes in and does, what is that, like all the mastering, the EQs, the layering, or
no. So the music editor, there's a couple of different potential jobs for them. Sometimes you've got multiple music editors and each of them have their own job, but some of the jobs are like, for example, the music editor is the one who's going to create the temp score.
Okay.
The music editor is the one that at the end, once you've got all of the music from the composer, they're the ones who are going to set the levels against the movie.
Okay.
Right. They've got the first say and they've got the last say.
Wow. That's a lot of power.
Yeah. The composer has most of the like very, very obviously creative decisions to make, but the music editor does guide them in a direction and then can ultimately say, I don't like that cue, I'm gonna turn it very low in the film. And you can sort of tell if a piece was not liked, because the music is just gonna be quieter than it feels like it should be.
Interesting.
So often, okay. Often what that means is that they just don't love the music, but they need the music there. So it'll okay. be there just enough to like mask whatever it is they're trying to mask.
Yeah.
But it's gonna be so quiet that they're hoping that it doesn't draw attention to itself.
Okay. That's I never knew that because, like, what I'm learning today from our conversation is that within like in this like your world, let's call it, that you're entering into, there's so many more options than even I realized. Like, you said music editor. I'm like, okay, that's like one guy you'll bring on to like, you know, do exactly what you said. Not when you're saying like, oh, there's five and each one like focuses on like a specific thing.
Yeah.
So for you as the score writer, it would be to make your life as easy as possible, it'd be in your best interest to develop a great relationship with your music
Correct.
Editor, right?
Yeah. In fact, very, very often.
Are they teams usually?
They try to be.
Okay.
They very much try to be. Yeah. No.
Okay.
Being close with the music editor is very, very useful. It's essentially the music editor you're hoping is going to be the guy who goes to bat for you rather than against you.
Okay. He's not because if he has first and final say, is he your boss in a way?
No, he's.
Do you get why I would think that?
Yeah. More so of a coworker.
Okay.
Both of you are directly under the director filmmaker.
I wanted to come on to some of the misconceptions about the field, because from an outside's perspective, film scoring seems very, what's the word? Obviously, now I have a different perspective on it based on our conversation, so I know a lot more. But from an outside's perspective, it feels like one of the misconceptions about the field is the skills you learn, you can only use it for those particular things.
Yeah, I do think that there are some other places you can apply it. I mean, it's helpful for some of the related fields. Like, it's helpful for composition in general, not just for film or for video games. Music editors also very much can take advantage of this sort of skill set, though it is sort of in that sphere. It is a little bit of an isolate.
Yeah.
I've been studying it for 5 years, and I very much have advanced those skills.
Exactly. Yeah.
But you know, it's not like my math's gotten any better. So.
But you mentioned something about like creating those orchestral pieces that you wanted to actually start doing when you first started, but you've realized now that there's other things that you want to do, and music you did back then. Now you actually, that you didn't like, now is action music that
yeah,
you
exactly.
like. So it's crazy how that changes.
Yeah, it changes a lot. Because yeah, indeed, I did start off wanting to do those large orchestral,
like Hans Zimmer esque.
More so John Williams.
Okay, okay,
because Hans Zimmer, he embraces the technology a lot more. He's much more. He plays with texture a lot more. So I've actually been pushed more in Hans Zimmer's direction.
Okay.
But I very much I've fallen in love with the creating of soundscapes and textures, and it's a lot of fun to just play around in a space like that.
Yeah, I can and kind of like reflecting on our entire conversation, like your world, like from a creativity standpoint, it's just like a blank slate. Do, combine, add, subtract, multiply, shift, whatever you want, you know, just in whatever way you think would bring out the best in this, you know, in this work.
So, yeah.
I wanted to ask you, so I guess, so in your, for you personally, what is like the, I guess, what's the dream job? If I told you, Lander, tomorrow I'm going to come give you the dream score that you've imagined all of these 5 years putting into one day, right? What type of project is that? Is it, for example, we can start small. Is it like a film or a movie? And then you can break down what about it?
Even at that level, you know, I've sort of got a couple. I've got a couple of different ones that I've got on my bucket list.
Why don't you share some with us? What are the bucket list ticks that you want to do?
So on the film side, I want to work on a film that's got a decent music budget, like enough so that I would be able to afford a decent sized string orchestra.
Okay.
I happen to love strings more than anything. They are such lovely instruments and work really well with the type of music that I personally like to write anyway.
Okay.
So a film that would allow me to record a full score with a string ensemble would be incredible.
Yeah. I guess in that kind of scenario, you're kind of like the maestro in a way. Because you're the one to tell them, guys, I need this, I need that, I need that. Do this now, do that now,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yes, yeah. Essentially. I mean, that's essentially what I've been doing in my master's.
Oh, okay.
The reason that Bulgari was so appealing is that we got, I want to say it's like 11 or so recording sessions that we get throughout our year there. So we're actually getting to record these with ensembles. I just last Saturday I was recording with an ensemble for strings and woodwinds.
Wow. So how's that experience like, leading something like that? Because I can imagine that's so cool.
Yeah, no, it's magical, especially when it goes well. There's obviously sometimes it's just a train wreck, and
sure,
you sit there like, oh, all of that time, and you know, I'm missing something, like something's gone wrong, and it's but mostly it's gone quite well. I've had a lot of luck with my recording sessions. I can really only point to one that I was like, oh boy,
one to forget.
Yeah, it was one to forget. But most of them, at least there were some parts that I was able to use, and I'm currently waiting on that last recording from Saturday so that I can start finalizing it.
Okay. Whenever you get a chance, I'd love to, if you just send me the file, I'm just curious to hear an example of what you've done, just so I can see, because I want to take everything we've discussed today and like watch some of your work with this in mind, so I can like actually be aware and look out for the thing, like certain things. Or maybe there might be 90% that I don't find, but at least now there might be a couple of things I do.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that is sort of where, again, you've got such variety in it that you really don't need an ensemble, like a full ensemble, to create good music. You know,
right, yeah.
You can get a long way with technology, especially if you're in a genre that's conducive to it.
Yeah.
I can absolutely send you.
Yeah, I would love some. I'm just curious, you know. I like to learn. I like seeing other people's work. It's a field that I know nothing about.
Yeah.
My only editing and audio skills are like for my podcast. It's only two cameras. I have no overlays, no other different audio things I need to do. It's just, does he sound good? Does I sound good? All right, we're good.
Yeah, fair. Yeah, it's those recording sessions are a little bit more in depth than that. I would hope so. I don't know how many microphones they've got in there, but it is intimidating once I get the file, because it's you know, I receive the file and I've got to balance out like 18 different microphones, and it's a lot of work.
Okay, that's even
that's the part of the work I don't like.
How do you bring all that together? Shit.
Very carefully.
Yeah.
Very carefully. Yeah.
Well said.
It's a lot of work. You've got a lot of techniques you've got to keep in mind, and honestly, that is absolutely the part that I wish I could get rid of.
But, yeah. And I guess because everything we discussed is also things to keep in mind when you're writing things. You also have like deadlines and timelines. So, I guess there's also an art to learning to not only creating a good score, but being efficient in your composition process.
Yeah, no, absolutely. More and more nowadays, you're getting less and less and less time to create a full in-depth score. It's some of the timelines that you see nowadays are insane. It's wild to hear some of the more extreme stories of it, of people who really just essentially, even at the like highest level, you're talking about people who essentially just have to lock themselves away for 2 weeks. Basically they celebrate a going away party and they just live in their basement for the next 2 weeks, aren't seen by family or friends, and then they escape.
Yeah. Because even with my editing for my podcast, like I wouldn't classify myself as a good editor. I would say I can edit, and yep. I'm always learning little bits and tricks, whatever. For what I do, it's
perfect.
I don't need more. Yeah. Always want to improve it, of course. So recently been trying a couple of different things. But like I've seen the time it takes to like just even edit a one hour and a half podcast. Podcast, and usually if like the audio is good and the camera and you know everything is set up, like there isn't much that I need to do besides like make sure like I wouldn't want it to cut there, I'd want it to cut here instead. Yeah. Or like something like that, you know, and lining up the audio is simple stuff, but even that takes me why film when I was getting into this whole world myself, although I'm like, you know, I play with the kids over here, you know, not with you guys. Yeah. Now it then made me understand like, oh wow, so like that's why when you say movies take like 3-4 years to make, I'm like, yeah, because half that time is probably just the edits.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Which is insane.
Video terrifies me.
Video is a different beast in itself. It's crazy.
It really is. I've been trying to figure out how video works. I sort of need to. I'm currently in the process of trying to compile some of the footage from the recording sessions, but it is a nightmare to try and figure out all of the details for it to be in a publishable form.
Yeah. There's like video taught me about there's so many for example lights.
Yeah,
lighting. I didn't even know about the importance of lighting, and now I've understood through my experience. I'm like, oh, lighting could make or break a scene or a movie, or if it's not color graded correctly, or color grading. Don't even get me started on that. At least with the lights, I can be like, make brighter, a little less bright. Put orange tint, like basic shit. That's what I'm saying. I do basic things. But it is, I must say, when you learn a new trick or you change even one frame or whatever, like a new technique you're trying out in that process, is very satisfying. When it works out, you're like, oh, it's not as hard as I thought. I can layer that and I can put this here and try and whatever, you know what I mean? So yeah.
Yeah, no, 100%. And that's sort of where it's really intimidating, especially to like get into it at first. I've just spent all of my energy just really focusing audio, and video's sort of just sitting there in my peripheral like, yes, I know you're there. I know you're there. I need to learn the basics. But yeah. I could also instead.
Yeah. Focus more time on here. You know, what other audio
focus
things
on
can
the
I
audio
do?
Again.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I mean, that I am always going to need to be better at.
Of course. Yeah, for sure. Especially, you know, for the work you're doing, it makes complete sense why you dove down into that.
Yeah.
Linda, I just have two more questions for you, my man. Alrighty. These are questions I ask all my guests. So looking back either, personally or professionally or whatever the case might be, when I ask you the question, what are you most proud of for yourself? What would you say?
Oh, that's a tough one. What I'm most proud of is honestly probably the fact that I've actually managed to commit to doing this. It was very intimidating And I mean, still is. It's, you know, I'm going to escape my studies and I'm not going to be sure of exactly where I need to go. But I'm really proud of the fact that I've actually managed to overcome that fear. Because the truth is, I don't know what I would be doing if it weren't for this.
Okay.
I can only imagine a world in which I considered it, didn't do it, and then came to regret it. Because I love creating things and I love music so much. The idea at this point of not doing it anymore is... I can't imagine.
It's no longer an option.
Yeah.
Yeah. But... even from our first conversation, Linda, your passion and love for this comes across instantly, you know, like, because even when you talk about it, you have a smile, and when you're explaining things and so on. To not only do this in spite of the fear, but commit to it and now be at the end and about to start a beautiful, hopefully long career. You should be very proud of yourself, because that the lesson in there, or why you're proud, just like with everyone else, I was scared to do it. Not only did I do it, I committed to it and I fucking killed it.
Yeah.
Take those three things, put it to anything, everyone would be proud of something, right?
Yeah, no, 100%. It is sort of interesting, because I feel like the scariest part sort of is this next year. A year and a half, 2 years, when I'm really trying to find my footing and
the unknown,
you know, confirm to myself, yeah, this really is possible, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that what I've sort of realized is that at this point, yes, it gets more and more scary. It's more and more intimidating, but I've grown so much more convinced that I need to do this that I can't sit in that fear anymore.
Yeah.
So even in the absolute worst moments, and there've been a few.
I'm sure.
There's been absolutely no question that this is what I need to do.
Look, if in the tough moments, that was the answer you kept coming back to, then that's the answer. You know, so I'm proud of you, man, for committing and going through it, doing it in spite of the fear. I appreciate you, you know, taking the time to educate me about this world today. I knew fucking nothing about it. Now I might know 5% more, but like at least there's more. I know a little bit more.
5% is 5%.
I'll take 5%.
If I learned 5% about what I do in any single day, I'd be very happy.
It's the small wins that, you know, come, that all come together at some point. And for my last question, Leendert, my man, what is the message that you'd like everyone to take home with them today?
Oh, wow, really, really heavy hitters at the end. Man, that's a tough one. I feel like I come from a position of, you know, I've been very fortunate to be in the position that I'm in, and even with that all calculated, I've also, you know, I'm still very new in this entire field, so I feel like I with something like that, I sort of come from a position of still very, I've, you know, youthful energy still. Mm-hmm. In this. I don't have that. I don't have the gray hairs that, you know, show that I've got all those years working in this, you know.
Yeah.
But it's the big thing, honestly, that I can think of that's been really important to me is you can't really turn your back on the things that really call out to you as being something you need to do. You know, there are some moments in life that you feel a need to pursue something. It doesn't matter what it is, but sometimes something just calls to you. And to close that door, I think, is the biggest disservice you can do to yourself. Mm. You know, whether that is for career or otherwise, it's what has brought me all of the great fortune that I have been so lucky to receive.
Yeah.
And I think that that's the big one.
I think that is incredibly powerful because I think a lot of us throughout our lives, and even people your age, my age, older, whatever, there's that, you said something, a very important word there, which is something calls to you. Like, yeah. It's a calling. It's like you can't, you enjoy doing it so much that you can't imagine a world where you don't do it.
Yeah.
Now, does that mean you're going to be successful at it? Not necessarily. But I think from what I take from what you're saying, it would be a disservice to not at least give it like a proper try.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Because the truth is, you know, sort of what I was saying about in the segment of, you know, what was I proud of? Because if I would have turned my back on it, I feel like it would forever be this massive what if, even if I were successful there, because it really the call was that strong.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a particularly spiritual person, but sometimes you are in situations where you do feel compelled to do something that is right for you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Something that the heart needs.
The heart. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, man. So. Look, if you, to have found it at such a young age, you're already leaps and bounds ahead of, I'd say, 90% of the world, bro. A lot of people don't know what their calling is, don't know whatever, like,
I was extraordinarily fortunate with that. I realized that very, very early on.
But people like yourself who find out about it early on and are like just tunnel vision to it you have a head start, you're starting from a young age, you are gonna fucking kill it. There's so many success stories that you hear that, okay, there's obviously different types and different whatever, but a lot of them is like, yeah, I knew. I wanted to be an entrepreneur since I was 10. And I was selling like a lemonade stand. And then I did newspapers and I cleaned this and I went whatever. Or take that story and fit in whatever you want, whatever type of career, whatever type of thing.
Yeah.
So when you say you're fortunate to have it, I would agree. Yeah. Because it's a rare thing to find. My calling, which I found by pure luck, is what we're doing right now.
Yeah.
This is it. This is what, there's nothing more in the world I love than sitting down, having a engaged conversation with a person. I don't care about the topic.
Yeah.
Because I'm just going to learn.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I do this podcast, I've said it before, selfishly. I do it for me first and then I do it for everyone else.
Yeah.
You know, this is what I'm interested in. This is the person I want to speak to. I think they're cool. This is what I want. If you like it too, great. If not, well, that sucks.
Fair.
Then I'm not the show for you.
Yeah.
My man, Lane, I want to say thank you so, so much, man, for coming on the show. This has been such a refreshing conversation for me. And in different ways, not only is it in a field that I don't know, like a brand new field in a way to me, but typically the guests I've had on my show are usually older than me or my age or whatever, like in that, you know, it's rare to have I get to speak to someone like yourself, someone like young, hungry and passionate. Not to say like I'm a dinosaur, but I'm definitely not 22 anymore. You can see the head. So I want to say thank you for educating myself and all of us about this world that, you know, that you're going into and the ins and outs of it and stuff. I think anyone listening to this conversation can take so many things away, not necessarily just about this about what you do, but the lessons and the messages that underlie all those different things. Yeah. So thanks so much, man. I really appreciate it.
And thank you so much for having me. It really is a pleasure. I love talking about the things I love. It's,
who doesn't?
Yeah, it's easy to go on and on about the things that matter to us.
Absolutely.
It's always a pleasure to get to share those.
My man, appreciate it. Guys, to everyone listening, if people want to reach out to you, work with you potentially, is there any way, what's the best place for them to get in touch with you?
The easiest place will probably be just on my website.
Okay.
You can find me at LeindertVanTreet.com.
Oh, okay, great. We'll make sure to put that in the show notes then, so perfect. People can go check that out. Right. Leinder, my man, thank you so much again. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Guys, so everyone listening, thank you so much for your time. Please make sure to like, share, and follow, and subscribe to the podcast at Hope It Helps Pod on all channels. And as always, guys, hope it helps. Peace.